Okay. We're going to call the Climate Protection Committee to order. Roll call.
On the roll for the Climate Protection Committee meeting of March 15th, 2018, Director Joya.
Here.
Director Haggerty. Director Kaplan.
Here.
Director Kim.
Here.
Director Sinks. Director Rice. Director Ross.
Here.
Director. Oh! Wagon Connect.
Here.
Director Zane. Committee Vice Chair Ronan. Committee Chair Barrett.
Here.
Board Chair Hudson. We have a quorum.
Great. Thank you. Let's stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with justice for all.
Public comment on non-agendized items. There are no cards. Moving on to approval of the minutes for November 16th. Is there a second?
I'll second
that. Okay, any objection? The minutes stand as submitted. Climate Protection Grant Program.
Yes, Madam Chair. Abby Young, our climate manager, is going to give you a presentation on our grant program.
Thank you, Director Barrett and members of the committee. Good morning. Today I'll be walking you through the Climate Protection Grant Program guidelines. And we'll start with what we're trying to accomplish with this program. So, of course, our overarching goal is to achieve greenhouse gas emissions and to do that by accelerating the implementation of our clean air plan that was adopted by the board last April. As we achieve greenhouse gas reductions, we want to make sure that we also achieve air quality co-benefits as much as we can, that we implement very specific measures that we've committed to in our clean air plan. We want to also help local governments implement the local climate action plans and greenhouse gas reduction programs and priorities that they have. We want to make sure that as we fund projects and choose projects for funding, that we benefit impacted communities as much as we can. And we also want to support very innovative approaches. We know that in order to reach our midterm and long-term greenhouse gas reduction goals, we're going to have to come up with not just new technologies, but new strategies and new ways of doing things that will help get us there. So innovative approaches are very important to this grant program. And finally, we want to fund things that we think have the potential to spread and be replicated, not just through the Bay Area, but through California and beyond as well. So the structure of the program, we have about $4.5 million available, and we are planning to fund in the range between $100,000 and $300,000. And part of this is feedback that we received from local government folks that we met with, saying that, you know, with sometimes cumbersome proposal processes, which we've designed this to not be cumbersome, but many staff-constrained and resource-constrained local governments have to really choose what they're going to apply for. And with limited resources, sometimes the lower grant amount programs are not the ones that they choose to invest their time in. So we want to make sure that the funding we have available is at a level that is helpful to local governments and that will also help them really accomplish something. And we are proposing that only public agencies are eligible applicants. And this is because we want to make sure that the way we invest our funds really supports the priorities and plans of local governments. Now, we welcome partnerships with nonprofits and businesses and other public agencies, but we want public agencies themselves to really be the drivers of this and be the applicants. And we're defining public agencies fairly broadly. So cities, towns, and counties, of course, but also special districts, school districts, community choice energy programs, et cetera. So here's the meat of the guidelines, what we are proposing to fund. And as we were thinking about this, and again in our outreach discussions with public agencies, we were really thinking about, well, do we want to go broad and fund lots of different types of things, or do we want to focus and go deep in one sector? And we decided we would do both. So we have two funding categories. This first one really digs deep. This is our deep category, and we focus on existing buildings and reducing greenhouse gases from existing buildings. And the reason we're doing this, number one, it's a large source of greenhouse gases. Certainly the electricity used in buildings, the natural gas for space and water heating and appliances, and even the short-lived climate pollutants, or we call them the super GHGs, that have very high global warming potential, like fluorinated gases we find in refrigeration and air conditioning in large buildings. So there's quite a lot of greenhouse gas to work with in existing buildings. But we also find that a lot of the funding and a lot of the policies that are addressing greenhouse gases in the building sector are really focused on new construction. But about 70% of the existing buildings in the Bay Area were constructed prior to Title 24's energy efficiency requirements. And about two-thirds of the buildings that are going to be around in 2050 have already been built. So when we think of the scale of the challenge and what we have to do to achieve our goals, that existing building stock really becomes very, very important. And we've heard from local governments that it's also a difficult piece of their community greenhouse gas emissions to really move the needle on. So we feel that targeting some of the funding in this direction makes a lot of sense. It's also one of the Governor Brown's five climate pillars, a statewide goal to increase energy efficiency 50% in the existing building stock by 2030. So we're supporting the state's objective as well. So what are the kinds of things that we might fund? And we're excited to receive proposals for many things that you don't see on this list. These are just examples of the kinds of activities. Funding things that make cultural shifts, working with technology vendors and contractors to make sure that the best technologies are being offered to building owners, looking at policies and how policies can be changed to incentivize and prioritize different types of practices, funding mechanisms, local funding strategies. So these are some of the things that we're hoping to see in our pool of applications. Now, our second category goes more broadly. This is funding innovative strategies is something that we did with our last climate protection program about 10 years ago. And we're, this time as well as last time, really looking for very, very new innovative ideas that may be game changers for the way we live and travel and behave moving into the future. So an example is back 10 years ago when we did this funding program, we funded innovative strategies, and one of the grants we gave was seed funding for the Marin Clean Energy Program, which of course has been a game changer in how we source and use energy in the Bay Area. Another project we funded was Berkeley First, which grew into and became the Property Assessed Clean Energy Program, or PACE program, that offers a whole new type of financing for existing buildings. So in some ways, we don't know what we're going to get, and that's exciting. But some ideas might be design and implementation of innovative funding mechanisms or combinations of policy drivers and incentives for technologies and new types of strategies, innovative use of social marketing to drive large-scale behavior change. So we're very excited to see what kind of applications we get in this category. Now, bringing us to this point, we've done quite a lot of outreach. Going back over a year ago, we conducted a survey of local government staff to try to assess where they were having problems in implementing local climate action plans and what kinds of funding and resources might be most helpful. So that was an early input into our thinking. And then last summer and fall, we conducted a series of meetings with public agency folks in every county and in some counties more than once to get input on what they would like to see out of this grant program in particular. We also met with some community-based nonprofits, with some funders in the climate area, certainly talking to MTC about their funding programs, the San Francisco Foundation, and making sure that we're a value added and we're not duplicating anything in the funding space. We also coordinated internally, certainly talking to our strategic incentives division, our technology implementation office, and our community outreach program to make sure that the way we're designing this program will complement and support their efforts. And then finally, as a direct request from this committee when we presented on this program back in September, was to make sure that we ran our draft guidelines by local government staff to make sure that we're not doing this in an onerous way, that we're addressing things that they would like to see addressed, that they understand the guidelines. And so we've done that, and we completed that process a few weeks ago. And some of the feedback from that process that we received, mostly overall supportive of the general program, the goals, the objectives, the funding categories. There was a lot of support for this. There's always, a desire for additional funding. So we did definitely hear, this is great, but we'd also like to have, some more funding for EVs, which we know is coming out of strategic incentives, or we'd, love to see more funding for climate action plans. And so we know there's always more things to fund. There was a request for us to include examples of the kinds of things that we'd like to see funded, and so we added to that portion of the guidelines. And one thing that was a pretty common request was that we give folks enough time to apply. So it seemed like people wanted to make sure they had at least a month from the time we release the final guidelines and call for applications to when they're due. And you'll see in a couple slides in our timeline that we do that. That was a very good suggestion. And then, of course, areas here and there where they asked for more clarification. And our outreach isn't stopping. We're of course, going to have a robust outreach program when we launch the call for applications. We're going to be emailing directly to public agency staff. We're going to, within the first week of the kickoff, we're going to have a webinar on the grant program, and that'll be archived on our webpage. We will have workshops across the region, and again, for any folks that can't make those workshops, we'll have that webinar archived on the website that they can see. Air District staff is available individually to answer questions and provide feedback, and we want to engage with you to help get the word out as well, and I'll talk a little more about that in a couple of slides. So our schedule is that hoping that this committee will recommend at the next board meeting as part of its report to the board that these guidelines will be approved. And upon that, we will launch the call for project and release the guidelines via our webpage, via emails, and convene the application or the application workshops. The deadline will be May 11th, so that gives us a little over 5 weeks, and we think that'll be a good amount of time for folks. And then we anticipate reviewing and evaluating and scoring the proposals through the month of May, possibly into the first week of June, taking award recommendations to the board in June, and then executing contract agreements in June and July. Now, how you can help. You can help us get the word out in your jurisdictions by communicating to the public agencies in your areas. And Air District staff will provide you with a sample email with all the links that you'll be able to send out. And we will work with your staff as we move forward with organizing and scheduling these informational workshops to make sure that we find good locations and schedule those appropriately. Thank you. Questions?
Okay, yes. I'm sure there's going to be plenty. Let's start on the right-hand side, and then we'll move around. Director Kim?
Thank you. Thanks for the presentation. Of the $4.5 million, are you going to earmark a certain amount for each program?
Good question. No, we're not. We want to maintain as much flexibility as we can because it depends on what kinds of applications we're going to get. We don't want to decide in advance that a certain amount will be devoted to buildings and then see that maybe, you know, we don't have enough applications in that area. So we want to maintain some flexibility.
So I was just wondering, the innovative ideas category, it seems, you know, these are game changer ideas. Would that be funding R&D, sort of proof of concept?
Right. No, and we do list in the guidelines some certain things that we would not fund. So, for example, and R&D is one of them, for specifically for technologies. Another example would be that we won't fund marketing of specific technologies for profit. and there's a few more examples of things that we would not fund. And part of that is we don't want to conflict too much with our technology innovation office as well.
So in the end, those projects would all actually produce greenhouse gas reductions?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
Thank you.
Thanks for the presentation. I was looking back also at the presentation that was made back in September, and there was some language used. I was trying to find it in looking at the grant guidelines. I didn't see it. Maybe I missed it. That I thought was really good language, and it talked about the need for innovative projects to be scalable.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see that. Part of, as you know, a lot of the sort of statewide cap and trade program is about, you know, to the extent that it's investing in some new technologies, it's the kind of technologies that can be scalable. I looked at the grant guidelines. Did you talk about that? I didn't see it, but it was in. You used that word specifically in your September 2017 presentation. I didn't see it here, and it seems like that's a really important concept in talking about innovation.
Okay. Yeah.
So maybe having the grant guidelines include that concept, and maybe it's in because I tried to read through all your text. It's a long set of guidelines. Did you use that? I know you didn't use it in a PowerPoint, but I was trying to find it in the guidelines.
You know, we use the term replicable.
Yes, right.
Right. And so I think
that's fine. Yes.
Okay.
I mean, replicable. In fact, I think you used replicable or scalable back in September. In terms of the buildings, so while these grants go to local government, the eligible buildings are multifamily buildings,
yes.
Let's say, a program that's set up by local government, or government buildings themselves?
Correct.
So it could be either a public building or a program that, let's say, Contra Costa County put a program together for low-income communities to upgrade. We could do that.
Absolutely.
Or it would be government buildings as well. What's the source of the funding for this?
So that is a general fund.
It's general fund.
So we can do what we're
not
hampered
by. So we have a lot of flexibility.
Mm-hmm.
There's been a lot of, some of our programs provide some guaranteed level of funding for more highly impacted communities. I didn't see that in here.
Yeah.
Like our care communities or whatever. Is there a reason we didn't consider that? It seems to me that one of the issues that gets raised is, are those highly impacted communities often have at least some some priority or some guaranteed amount?
Right. There's no guaranteed amount, but we do have a scoring consideration for projects that are located in or benefit impacted communities.
And is that, show me, where in the guidelines is that?
So
I'm
that
looking
is...
here. You do say objective four, engage
right.
and benefit impacted / care communities.
It's
so
in...
does that, but is there a point, there is then a point, some points for that?
Yes, it's in the scoring criteria.
Oh, okay, got it. All right, under, yes, my colleague here's point on page 16, there's for the scoring, just looking at that.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not, but
no, it's on page 10.
Page
yeah.
10, right. Okay, the scoring. Okay. Those were, I think, looks like that was, right, it's 5 points. So it's some value. It's not a high value out of 100. 5 out of 100. I mean, we may hear that there needs to be maybe some more thought to that. I'm not suggesting to go as far as sort of some of the state legislation that has, you know, that has said, you know, in many cases over 25% of funding going to impacted communities, but I think it should be more than 5 points. I think it should be, there should be greater consideration. We talk about trying to focus on our care communities, which are around the Bay Area, you know, spread around the Bay Area. So I'll raise that issue, but that's a point to consider. Of whether we want to value that more than 5 points out of 100.
Good, yeah.
I mean, and your internal thinking on that? It's a policy call for us. I guess we'll put it. I'll put it up just for discussion.
Madam Chair, if I may, Director Joya, I'm over here. Sorry, just to add on to Abby's remarks. So we call out on that page that you've seen the 5 points specifically for care areas, but we also have a category that speaks to support for air district goals and objectives. Now that's fairly broad, but I think certainly our emphasis on working with impacted communities is one of our core agency goals and objectives. So I think if we really see projects that we want to support in impacted communities, there are other ways of rewarding and recognizing those projects.
Yeah, I like things to be direct.
Okay.
I mean, then there's, I'm just raising it. I don't know if others feel that way, but in the past we've talked about that. And I think that's an important value.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to jump in here. The only public agencies are eligible applicants, Director Joya just brought up so that cities who perhaps have partnered to make low-income housing with Burbank or Eden or one of the big could use that money for such projects. What about other existing buildings that are not necessarily have public input, you know, funding? You know, because that, in at least in our community, is not as significant as, you know, because those are, first of all, they're multiple home family homes, so they are less impactful than a lot of single family homes in terms of the large number of those that are producing a lot more greenhouse gas. And retrofitting those would be a very good thing, mm-hmm. but they're privately owned. So,
right. Well, if the a jurisdiction wanted to create an incentive program or some kind of funding mechanism or outreach program or some kind of program targeting those types of buildings, that would certainly be something that could be fundable.
Okay. All right. Well, except for. Then you're down to 100 to 300,000. So, okay, I just wanted to ask that. So, question?
I just wanted to agree with Director Joya in wanting to see more explicit priority going to care communities or low income neighborhoods that are usually much more impacted by air pollution.
Director Ross?
And I would echo that same comment. And also on the...
Yeah, Martinez would be a fall in that category, wouldn't it, Mark? Right.
Yeah.
Because you have a couple of refineries out there.
Yeah, we always have our hand out. Yes.
Right. No, I'm saying I agree. This is right.
Have you heard of the term too much honesty?
Well, I was just agreeing. I didn't... the reasons why I guess, are evident now. But
no, for all of us.
But on the scalability would also be of importance to me, because a little bit of reduction with a lot of people or a lot of points would be is much more effective than perhaps one project at a time. But I look forward to seeing the projects that do come forward. I have a lot more to say, but I think I'll reduce greenhouse gases and just pass on that.
Thank you.
Director Wagner.
Yeah, I especially appreciate the idea of the CCAs being included in this. They're kind of a between the boards, their boards, and their staffs, they're kind of a gathering of thoughts on climate change and climate protection. The other part of it is that they're all tied to cities and counties, and so you have that automatic scalability at that spot.
Director Kaplan.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. I also want to agree with Directors Joy and Rona. I do think, and whoever else said it too, I do think we should increase explicitly the number of points for care communities, and not just say that it could fall in another category. Also, if the list of eligible agencies does not explicitly now mention housing authorities, so I'd like us to explicitly mention housing authorities so that it's clear to them that they would be eligible, because I think if we're talking about retrofitting existing buildings, you know, insulation, things like that, you know, affordable housing projects should be eligible for that type of use. In addition, I wanted to share something that I've been asked by various potential applicants, which is, you mentioned that, you know, if the dollar amounts aren't so big, it's not worth it for them to apply. We could also look at it from the perspective of the ease of applying, and are there steps we could take to make it less work to apply? Because, of course, you don't want a public agency doing $200,000 worth of staff work to get a $100,000 grant. And so I would encourage just that be looked at as we're trying to figure out, you know, how do we get more people to apply for some of these type of things? You know, if there are ways we can streamline the amount of paperwork we require, I think we'll get more applicants. I also heard the comment that some had suggested that, you know, we want to see more examples of what's eligible, because people don't want to do this work without knowing if the thing they have is eligible. So I wanted to throw out some specific suggestions that we might want to name. There's a technology that now is CARB certified that's commonly referred to as bonnets, which is essentially when you have either a train or a ship that has smokestack, basically emissions, you can put a capture device over the smokestack that captures those, you know, whether that would be eligible. Programs to promote carpooling looks like it would be eligible, but people might not be sure. Public transit education and outreach to encourage transit ridership, I think would be obvious that it should be, but again, people might not guess that. There's some good innovative stuff right now being funded by Alameda County Transportation Commission on using information technology to clear truck backlogs. We have throughout our region a lot of places where trucks are idling because they're in line, right? They're idling in line, and that information technology solutions that gives them scheduling and, you know, text messages when it's time to come and things like that can actually clear truck backlogs a lot. So that's something that could be expanded. I think insulation and weatherproofing presumably is covered, would be a, especially if you're talking about existing buildings. And you clarified that even though public agencies have to apply, public agencies can use the money for programs that take place on not publicly owned properties. So we should probably say that, so the potential public agencies that might want to do like a homeowner weatherproofing incentive program would know that that is allowed. And my last note, which I already said, was add housing authorities. So, and then on places to send this to get it out there, our county's congestion management agencies would be another place to send this to get it out to potential applicants. Thank you.
Since the fall, when we've started having conversations and meetings with public agency folks, we've been getting a lot of ideas submitted to us, and we've had, you know, individual phone calls, and we've even had some early letters of interest submitted, and the guidelines allow for you know, early letters of interest if people want specific you know, more feedback on ideas. So these are conversations definitely that we've been having. So hopefully providing a little bit more guidance to potential applicants.
Director Rice? Yeah, just thank you very much, Abby. Two things. One, if you could let us know maybe the agencies and or individuals that you've had real direct contact with in our counties, and so that we're not scaring up names that you're already in contact with. We kind of have a sense of where you've been out in our areas. And then two, I'm wondering if there's the ability, or maybe it's already built into the program, to actually be sharing early on what some of the potential project ideas are, because it may be that one county or jurisdiction is actually driving at something that will have, that has broad interest, and so we're not so that counties and or jurisdictions, whatever, aren't competing for a similar type of project. Frankly, I think that, so many of our jurisdictions are smaller and resource stretched, and if they know that there is an agency somewhere that is looking at and driving at something that they have an interest in, they just put their weight behind that one and say, go for it, especially if replicability is important. And I'm really interested on the category two, innovative strategies around addressing really going after barriers to GHG reductions, whether it's around, you know, building out the transportation charging grid or what have you. But anyway, I think sharing in a competitive environment in this case might be a good idea.
Yeah, and that's something we've thought a lot about, and we've built into the process an optional letter of interest that, particularly if people are looking for that kind of, you know, matching, so that Air District staff can, as best we can, anticipate where we might have similar types of applications, and we can connect folks.
Okay. Director Hudson?
I forgot. No. Oh. I don't agree with John. I'm sorry. I don't want to see necessarily the care areas increase, but it's self-serving since I'm a care area. And the reality is that I'm a care area that isn't a low income, and we don't separate those two sometimes. We're trying to do a lot for low income. I mean, we've got cap and trade off the top. We've got the One Bay Area grants off the top. There's a lot of money going in that direction. But what we're really, in my opinion, trying to do is seed the idea that start thinking about efficiencies and conservation. So 300,000 and 4.5 million will spread it to more places. What I'm finding is we're doing so much grant funding at higher numbers that people are deciding to do things because it's almost, well, it is beneficial for them, but I mean, we're paying for it, and only a few get it when we have higher grants. I would like to focus on the priority list that we have. I have to put these back on, with first the cities and then the counties. Example for me, my electrical bill, month after month after month, on the low end is $77,000. Why aren't we on solar? Now, if they want to come in with a program like that, or efficiencies for an old building that we have, I think that's perfect for this. Should be doing it anyway. And if we don't have the 100,000, they're just going to pay 100,000 more. But everybody is going to be into this program, if not by 2020, shortly after, when they realize how much you're going to have to reduce. We don't need to run out of money before then.
Just got a comment?
Yes.
So in the comment, and it seemed to be several people, not just me, that believe the care communities. I was just saying we have a fair amount of, as you know, care communities throughout the Bay Area in impacted areas, and they're pretty broadly spread out. And we're not changing the priorities of the program. The priorities of the program are exactly, I think the staff that took our input from September and did a really good job laying out the priorities of the program. It's just that if that priority program is in a care community, it gets a few more points. That was my point. And then there seems to be, and because otherwise, if we just talk a game and say that we want to help our care communities and we're going to do more meetings and we're going to hear what they have to say, I know we've tried to provide more grant opportunities for those areas, admittedly, and this is, I think, a perfect opportunity for that. Just, so I don't know. In hearing that, how would you think about what would be your thinking if we wanted to increase the points?
Right, and I should also point out
Abby,
that.
Can I, sorry, I'd like to suggest an option for the committee's consideration, if I may,
certainly.
Chair. As Henry pointed out earlier, we have 20 points for consistency with air quality goals. What I would suggest is that we make it more explicit in there that extra points would be awarded to projects that reduce exposure to air pollutants in AB 617 communities. Mm-hmm. And I think that gets at kind of the core of the committee's concern and allows us to keep sort of the same structure that we have.
You mean under this 20 points? Of
right.
course, someone could make up the 20 points by meeting another goal of the district that has nothing to do with care communities.
That would be correct. Yeah.
So in other words, are you really giving, in other words, if let's say a non-care community may have another goal of the district that's meeting, and so it gets 20 points. And a care community, you're getting extra points. So you're getting extra points for a care community, but there's many different ways to get those 20 points. I'm not certain. I think it's a good intention, but I'm not certain it gets you more because there's many ways to reach district goals.
I guess I just would like some clarity from the committee. It would be helpful if the intent is really about funding prioritization or about prioritizing projects that provide tangible air quality benefits to
right.
overburdened communities.
Well, and just let me be clear, I was just saying, I'm agreeing that the priority are the guidelines. It's just that sometimes when you prioritize, if you have two projects that are very similar, we're trying to figure out how do we give, in other words, it has to meet all those other guidelines, and it has to sort of imply that a care community project's not going to reach those guidelines. They have to meet those other guidelines. It's just that all other things being equal, if it's a close call, there's some opportunity for care communities. It just seemed that 5 points out of 20 didn't provide that. I don't know whether it's 10 points out of 20, but at least makes similar projects. You still have to meet the other goals.
Right. I mean, I was just trying to bridge kind of comments from some board members, comments of Director Hudson, and trying to interpret the guidance from this committee.
Good luck with that.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Director Kim?
Yeah, my comments are trying to bridge this too. So I'm a huge supporter of prioritizing funding in care communities. And when we're talking about reducing particulates and toxics, it's all about local impacts, you know? So where I was a little unclear, Abby, is if this program is focused on reducing greenhouse gases like methane, you talked about co-benefits, but there's really not a lot of language in here about co-benefits. So if this is going to reduce localized pollutants, like Greg said, if this is going to reduce localized exposure, then I'm all in on giving more points to care communities. But if this has no connection to localized impacts, then the connection to care communities is not as strong, then?
Co-benefits.
Co-benefits, rather.
The
right.
Co-benefits do. Better.
So does the program really talk about co-benefits, or is
yes,
the language that
does.
Greg suggested a way to make sure that we benefit local communities as well?
I think the language Greg suggested strengthens what we have in the guidelines. We talk about co-benefits as one of the objectives, and the guidelines allow the applicants to discuss that qualitatively in their proposals. So perhaps Greg's suggestion would give a little more guidance to how we would like them to discuss co-benefits.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the relationship is between some of these greenhouse gas reductions and localized pollutants, but in the spirit of what was discussed here, I think if we can find a way to prioritize projects that have more local co-benefits and
yes.
reducing particulates.
I think that's a lot of what this is about. Is you talk about co-benefits in the grant guidelines, maybe you need to be clear where you get extra points too for achieving the co-benefits. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
So that would be in the section of the scoring where we talk about support for the program objectives. So, and one of the objectives being achieving co-benefits.
Is that quantified?
We don't ask the applicants to do that. We would ask them to discuss it qualitatively. We do ask them to quantify greenhouse gas reductions from their projects.
Okay, so, you know, in the point breakdown is, even though you might have 5 points here, 5 points there, are 5 points here worth more than 5 points there? Are they weighted?
They're not weighted.
5 points is 5 points.
They're not weighted. The points are not weighted.
Okay. 5 points are 5 points.
Right. And what we do, and we give qualitative guidance on, so, you know, let's say for care communities, you know, you could get up to 5 points. Well, these are the kinds of things we take into consideration when we think about, are you going to get 1 point or are you going to get 5 points? And things like, well, is the project actually located in a care community versus is the program, you know, maybe located more generally, but a care community definitely benefits from the program. So we have some qualitative discussion under each of the scoring criteria that helps the applicant understand the things that we're going to take into consideration when we determine how many points they get in that category.
Okay, looking to other directors, do you want to weigh in on this? Because we do want to come to some consensus.
Yeah, I just want to say, the primary objective here is around greenhouse gas reduction. So if you end up with a point scoring and the greenhouse gas reduction at the is equal, then you're looking for the co-benefits. But I think we need to keep on our eye on the ball around the greenhouse gas reduction as the primary objective.
Okay.
I would agree with that.
Okay, and I'm just going to weigh in here. I actually agree with that, too, because it seems to me that even though 5 points is not, what you would like, Director Joya, it does seem to me that it's five.
You keep pointing me out, but there were several directors that commented about this.
But
okay.
You did bring it up, so I
did.
I don't mean to. I hope you're not embarrassed by that. No. Yeah.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah. I totally understand.
I proudly
that.
Brought it up. I am glad.
I don't want to just ignore the fact that you were the one who brought it up, and so it certainly isn't meant to be pejorative. At any rate, that's 5 points that other areas cannot get. And so that right there is a plus. And I do think that Director Rice's point that the greenhouse gas reduction is mm-hmm. the point mm-hmm. of this grant should not be underestimated.
Yeah.
So
can I just add 1 point?
Well, wait, maybe someone else would like to, since you're not the only one who
sure.
is in
okay.
favor of this.
That's fine. I was going to say I agreed with the co-benefit issue.
Well,
I think co-benefits are
great. Someone else
say
something. Thank you.
I'll try to back you up here, Director Joya. While greenhouse gas reduction is the prime objective, if there are two projects that both achieve that reduction and one happens to be in a care area and one doesn't, I think, especially given the fact that, one of our goals is to improve the emissions from existing buildings, and oftentimes buildings in care areas are run down and can have other co-benefits. It's about bringing resources to communities that historically haven't had the resources. And if two communities are both going to achieve the same greenhouse gas reduction, but one happens to be in a care community, I do think that we should be giving more points to that project.
And that is the 5 points that we are giving them. Yeah. So I think that the way it's set up, all things being equal, the care district has an additional 5 points.
I understand that. I don't think it's enough. I think that especially given one of our goals is the existing buildings, and existing buildings, the care communities, while it's not the same as low-income communities, they are often one and the same, and those buildings tend to be much more run down and probably energy inefficient. And so I have a value that I think we in all of government, we need to be bringing more resources to those communities. And I personally would value that at more than 5 points.
And what was the number you had in mind?
I would say 10. But I don't know. I need to see the breakdown. Can I go look at the breakdown?
Okay. Is there anyone else who wants to weigh in on this?
I was just seconding her motion to make it 10 points. I'm interpreting that as a motion.
No motion.
Seconding it.
I wished I had it taped. Greg asked us for a priority, essentially, one way or the other. I would just tell you, I can't remember what it is, but it was the latter. I hear greenhouse gas, and I have to break this up. To me, the most effective reductions of the AB32, six greenhouse gases, to me is the priority. The co-benefit that I'm hearing, that is really my own personal priority, is the reduction of PM, which is a greenhouse gas, but it's not one of the AB32 greenhouse gases. I do believe the 5 points for the care area is sufficient because not all care areas have low income. I'm one of them. But if you are low income in the care area, that is the priority when it comes down to the two of them.
But there's no priority for low income in here. There's just a care priority, and care is care.
There is a care area
right
in the south of yeah. Contra Costa
right
that has been listed by the Times or some paper
so what's wrong
as the richest resident or the richest city in the country, and it's a care area, and I have a hard time, my city, saying, yeah, you're a priority over somebody, and I'm not everywhere in Richmond's
then Dave, take
low
your
income
city out.
Either.
If you don't want it to be a priority, just take it out.
Okay.
Because 95% of the care communities are not in
I'm taking
area.
Richmond out of the care area because not all are. But the point being is if there's a building that's in a low-income area and we do have different screenings, EnviroScreen is not the same as ours, but if you're in EnviroScreen and you're in a care area, you just move to the top of the list.
No.
He's the only one I think we have.
They're,
okay, can excuse me.
Anyway, okay.
Let's hold right, ourselves right. together here. Do we have any public comment on this issue? Okay, we don't have any public comment. I was hoping that we could just take a breath and listen to the public before we come back and try and resolve this.
I'm sorry.
But we're not getting there. So
I do think I'm hearing what could be a consensus, which is rather than adding more points for just being a care area, leaving the care area at 4 points and adding our policy direction to include low income also as a factor in addition to the 5 points you've already specified for care area, so that if it's low income, it gets some other prioritization beyond the 5 points for care areas.
Do I see any nodding?
Yeah.
On that?
Where would that come under the support for air district's goals and objectives?
I actually have a proposal around that.
I think there's a question.
Yeah. I know, but I was going to make a proposal to answer the question. So if you look at the breakdown of points, there's 25 points for greenhouse gas reduction, which I completely agree with. That should be by far the top points. And then there's 5 points for a strong budget and or what's the budget?
But strength of budget's 5.
Okay, and then there's 15 for cost effectiveness. Why don't, since those are, you know, they're. I'd love to hear how they're different, but I'm wondering if we could take 5 points from cost effectiveness and put it into low income.
Let me just address how they're different, which sure. doesn't necessarily address how we might all respond to your question.
Sure.
So cost effectiveness is simply amount of greenhouse gases tons that your project will be achieving divided by the amount of our grant. So we see, well, what are our dollars getting? Whereas the budget is more, have you thought out how you're going to achieve your deliverables? And, you know, does the strength of your budget really, you know, seem like you're going to be able to pull off this project? So that's how they're different. But now we, you know, yes. to maybe your question was more for your colleagues. Well, on the points.
I would, understanding that more fully, I would still make a proposal to my colleagues that we take 5 points from cost effectiveness. It's still 10 points, which is higher than
than other areas and move that into a new criteria or point priority around projects serving low-income neighborhoods.
I'm supportive of that.
So that's a second?
I'll second that.
Okay, any discussion on that? Is there any opposition to that?
You know, I don't have the scoring sheet in front of me, so I'm learning anecdotally.
It's in the package.
Okay, yeah. It's in the package. It's on page 10. Yeah, page.
I think $300,000 doesn't necessarily buy a lot of GHG reduction. What we're looking for is concept, and replicability from care community to care community wherever, and I think that staff probably has a good idea of what sort of ideas are going to be coming in. I'm happy to go along with the group, but I think we're fighting over something that maybe we don't need to be fighting over, or arguing, or discussing civilly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not the latter. If there's no opposition, we will just add a category for selection evaluation that includes low income and give that 5% take that out of the, or five.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It is 5%. Right. And take it out of the cost effectiveness.
That's fine. 5 points, right.
We came up with a better idea from the left wing. Yeah, it's 105% now, yeah. It just put a 5%. Don't take anything away from any category and you just get 5 points.
A little extra credit here?
That's fine. That's fine.
Okay, that's
fine. That 5 point bonus.
We have reached consensus.
Okay, all right. Okay, that works.
Okay,
that works.
Everybody take a deep breath.
Working together.
Thank you very much.
Good compromise. Good. San Francisco thought of something compromise here. That's
shocking.
Good.
Shocking.
That's good.
Okay, working my way back to
San Francisco and San Ramon working together. Look at that.
Okay, so now we're on to number five, update on the Air District's basin-wide methane strategy.
May I ask for clarification of who motioned and seconded, please?
Hillary Ronan from San Francisco, and it was seconded by John Gioia of Contra Costa.
But we both agreed to the recommendation made by Chair Hudson.
Yes.
Right.
Actually, it was Vice
Sorry,
Chair
it was
Rice.
Oh, Vice Chair Rice, yes.
He just said it.
Yeah, Madam Chair, we're gonna take that as direction to staff.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Go ahead.
All right.
Chair Barrett and members of the committee, glad to hear we're past our five-point conundrum. And Dr. Zamora is here to talk to us about our basin-wide methane strategy. As you all know, methane is a very important greenhouse gas pollutant. It is one that we don't think is adequately covered under cap and trade, and it's one that's not impacted by AB 398 restricting the Air District's authority. We've been doing a lot of work on this for a number of years, and we're getting close to the point to bring rules forward, and so Adanya is here to give you an update.
Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the Climate Protection Committee. Thank you, Greg, for the introduction. My name is Idania Zamora, and I am helping to lead the methane strategy. This morning, I am excited to present some of the exciting work we've been doing on this effort. Here is an outline of my presentation. I'll start with a brief overview of the methane strategy. And then I will provide an update on key efforts, including the ongoing methane emissions inventory work, and then two broad areas of focus to reduce methane emissions. The first is the development of a comprehensive strategy to reduce organics in the waste stream while minimizing air pollution and odors. And the second is the development of regulations to address methane from fossil fuel and biological sources. So let's start with our overview with the motivation behind the methane strategy. All right. Focusing on methane is a high-impact strategy to slow the rate of climate change. Methane, as you know, is a powerful greenhouse gas, up to 86 times more potent than CO2 on a 20-year time frame. Reducing its emissions can lead to public health and economic benefits. And the Air District not only has a critical role in meeting the state's methane emission reduction goal, but also has the full suite of actions within its authority to reduce methane. Now let's take a look at the methane emissions in the Bay Area. Here is the current bottom-up inventory. When considered on a 20-year timescale, sources in the Bay Area emitted an estimated of 10 million metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. That's roughly 10% of all Bay Area greenhouse gas emissions in 2015. Over half of these emissions, as you can see, come from the landfill sector. Then the next largest sources are livestock and natural gas, with approximately 15% each, followed by non-refinery stationary sources, as denoted in the category others, and wastewater treatment. Wetlands, refineries, and on-road mobile have had smaller contributions. However, relatively recent national and California studies have indicated that there are large unaccounted methane emissions in bottom-up inventories. More specifically for the Bay Area, two recently published top-down studies in which methane emissions are estimated based on ambient measurements found methane emissions around two times higher than our 2015 bottom-up inventory. The studies also found that most of that missing methane could be attributed to biological sources, with landfills accounting for most of those emissions. While this early work attributed total methane emissions to large sectors, there are still significant knowledge gaps in quantifying methane emissions from specific sources, particularly from facilities that recover and handle organics and from refineries. Now I'll explain a little bit more about the methane strategy. It is simply a coordination framework, I should say, for all the methane quantification and reduction efforts throughout the Air District. Our methane emissions inventory informs the research priorities, which then guide the Air District-led and contracted monitoring and measuring efforts that we are currently conducting, and then those feed again into improving the methane emissions inventory. Improving the inventory allows us to prioritize our methane emission reductions efforts, which span all of our divisions and include regulations, permitting, enforcement, and non-regulatory efforts such as the development of model ordinances and providing grants and incentives. Part of the methane strategy work includes building the staff's technical expertise in this area, as well as creating systems to allow for the close collaboration across divisions. For that purpose, we have created a methane expert panel series to gather technical advice from experts on different methane strategy topics, and have combined that with intense staff training and site visits. All right, now I will discuss the ongoing work on the methane emissions inventory. The emissions inventory group has designed a tiered approach to identify those underestimated sources of methane that these top-down studies are indicating we have. This approach starts by improving emissions estimates at the sector or facility level, and progressively zooms down to the source level. Tier one on the blue uses aircraft-based flux estimates with in-situ measurements to estimate facility-wide emissions. Tier two on the gray color leverages CEC and ARB-funded aircraft survey with an imaging spectrometer, lovingly called Averis-NG, to identify sources in site facilities. Tier 3 on the yellow employs different techniques of on-site leak detection and quantification. And I will describe each of those in more detail now. All right. So Tier 1, it's all about estimating facility-wide emissions. There's an outside group, Scientific Aviation, which conducts curtain flights to attempt to estimate emissions that are coming from certain areas. Methane emissions from facilities are carried downwind while being mixed and carried upward by turbulent air motion. And what the curtain flights do is the aircraft has a methane instrument, and they fly concentric circles starting at a very low altitude, 100 to 200 meters. And they continue to fly and detect methane all the way up until they stop detecting methane. And in essence, the assumption there is that all the methane emissions pass through the curtain eventually, and we're able to determine what is coming out of that particular area. These curtain flights have been conducted for all five refineries, several landfills, and a limited amount of wastewater treatment facilities in the Bay Area. The observed methane emissions from the refineries as a sector are approximately 10 times higher than estimated in our bottom-up inventory. Landfill sector emissions were determined to be approximately 2.5 times higher. And at this point, we still don't have enough information to revise the sector of wastewater treatment. If we were to scale these sectors in our inventory, based on these measurements, total methane emissions would roughly double. All right, so now I will discuss Tier 2. Tier 2 is all about locating emissions inside facilities. This work is being carried out by NASA JPL by placing their instrument on flight, so their flight surveys, and essentially they show us the methane plume. So here you can see a typical methane plume. You will find that the methane hotspots will be on the warmer colors toward the red, the higher concentrations. And here is just an example of a natural gas storage tank in the South Coast. And this is work that is being carried out by Riley Duran's group. So there is a California methane survey that has been carried out that includes some of our facilities, some of our refineries, landfills, and other locations. And we have seen some of that data, but some of that data is also going to be reaching us, and we'll be using that data to start locating emissions inside facilities, identifying sources. Now on Tier 3, it's all about measuring source emissions, so on-site leak detection and quantification. We have several techniques at our disposition to identify emission hotspots, perform source attribution, and quantify emissions from different processes or equipment. One of those is a FLIR camera, which is typically used as a screening to kind of observe where you might have some of the biggest methane leaks. The folks at the Emissions Inventory and Climate Protection Groups have also developed a GHG research van, which is capable of conducting fast measurements of carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and it is capable also to apportion the methane that it detects into biological or fossil fuel methane, depending on other accompanying pollutants that it's able to detect. We also have a very capable source testing group that can help with quantifying emissions from specific sources. I'll mention a little bit more about this work as I talk about Regulation 13.1 and our work with stakeholders for that regulation. Okay, so now, I'll switch gears and I'll talk about the true broad areas of reduction, of methane emissions reduction. The Air District has started work on the development of a comprehensive strategy to help reduce organics in the waste stream in support of the state's goals of diverting 75% of organic materials from landfills by 2025. This goal is expected to bring around 15 new large facilities to the Bay Area. And by that, I mean the facilities that would be processing and handling this organics. This interdivisional effort seeks to support organics recovery while preventing criteria, toxic and climate pollutant emissions, as well as odors. We'll be hosting an external stakeholder meeting with a few objectives in mind. Inform and seek input from community, environmental, and industry groups on the ongoing strategy work. Highlight the role of different efforts within the organics recovery lifecycle, and by that I mean regulations, the role of regulations versus incentives, for example. And seek collaboration with agencies working in the same space. We expect to host this meeting in the months of May or June, and we'll definitely keep you informed of that. All right, so now I'd like to discuss the other big area of focus, methane regulations. Here I am showing a methane rule development map to indicate the rough order in which we are considering regulation development for different sectors that emit both fossil fuel or old methane, and biological or new methane. Our first methane rule out of the methane strategy, Regulation 13.1, titled Significant Methane Releases, will span both types of methane as it applies to all the facilities in the district. On the oil and gas side, we'll be working to reduce methane in the natural gas distribution system, from crude oil and natural gas production, and eventually we'll be considering regulations for refineries. On the biological methane side, we'll be looking at rules for all the facilities that handle these organic materials, as well as landfills and wastewater eventually. So now I will focus on describing the regulatory efforts that are ongoing for this year. Rule 13.1, significant methane releases, will be the first air district rule to focus on climate protection by regulating methane. Its purpose is to allow the air district to compel facilities to fix major leaks or mitigate significant releases. Essentially, this rule will act as a backstop while we develop source-specific rules, and it is similar to Rule 8.2, which prohibits releases of VOCs above 300 ppm and 15 pounds per day. So it's sort of an equivalent, but for methane. I'd like to share some of the early concepts we have developed so far for Rule 13.1. Methane releases above 10,000 ppm will be considered significant and required to be minimized within 3 days and mitigated to below 500 ppm within 10 days. For point sources, there is a limited exemption that frees operators from this requirement if they can demonstrate that the release is under 10 pounds per day for 5 consecutive days. This exemption was added because a release might be of high concentration above 10,000 ppm, but the volumetric flow or rate of escape might be quite low or slow, so that the mass emissions are negligible or quite small. The current rule includes documentation and reporting requirements for each significant release. And notice I'm saying release because we are including both leaks and intentional releases at this point. But it does not include leak detection and repair, or LDAR, requirements at this point. It is anticipated that LDAR programs would be developed, if not already in place by other regulations, in the source-specific rules for each sector. One last point I'd like to make about this rule. During the month of March, we have been conducting pre-workshop stakeholder meetings with all the major stakeholders. The goal of these meetings was to share and obtain early input on some of these key concepts that I have described today, as well as to 2018 methane rules and the ongoing methane inventory work. Working with the stakeholders, staff has received positive feedback and has already identified potential areas of concern and or areas of improvement for the rule. Staff is also pursuing opportunities for collaboration with facilities on conducting on-site or tier three methane measurements. So that's also exciting. We may get to conduct measurements in some of the facilities that we have identified may be within that missing methane. We will continue to engage stakeholders on Rule 13.1 at workshops in April of this year and bring you this rule during 2018. So switching to the second part of the slide, we are also developing a suite of rules that address emissions from storing, transferring, and processing organic materials at composting, anaerobic digestion, and other related facilities such as landfills. These regulations will be a critical component of the organics recovery strategy that I described before. And the first of these rules is expected to come to the board during this year as well. All right, my last slide. Now I'd like to describe our efforts in the natural gas distribution sector. We are actively participating in an ongoing CPUC and ARB-led proceeding to develop it, to develop natural gas leak abatement program per SB 1371. Its purpose is to reduce methane leaks from the natural gas distribution system. Phase one of this proceeding was completed in 2017, and it resulted in 26 mandatory best practices for methane leak detection, quantification, and repair, and annual emissions reporting by utilities. We will continue working with the California Public Utilities Commission, or CPUC, and ARB during phase two of this proceeding to achieve quantifiable methane emission reductions. Finally, I will briefly describe our work on the oil and gas production sector. The Air District has an existing rule that was crafted in the 90s, Regulation 837, that focuses on this sector. However, it does exempt methane at this point. We are developing amendments to our rule 837 to be consistent with ARB's oil and gas rule and to address emissions from smaller facilities exempted by the rule due to their low production. We're currently conducting an active well pilot study to better understand the methane and toxic VOC emissions from these facilities during the months of January through March of this year. And depending on the results of the study, we might consider a lower leak threshold to achieve cost-effective methane and VOC reductions and protect public health. We also expect to bring this rule to the board in 2018. And that concludes my presentation. Thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll start on this side.
As a question on page 12, I see a lot of purple dots. What are they?
Page 12. Okay. One.
Existing landfills?
I'm in trouble with the microphone here. Sorry. Okay. Yes, they are existing facilities that deal with recovery and handling of organics. Okay.
They're not the some portrayal of the emissions from those landfills. It's just locating.
Just a map of locations, which is not completely up to date, actually.
Oh, what caught my attention is there are three on the bay, and that's it, out of all these landfills?
They're not necessarily landfills. I think they include different types of facilities.
That's where I was going. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah.
So, like, what besides the landfill?
Composting facilities, transfer facilities for the organic material. Oh, go ahead, Henry, did you? Yes.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
So I would assume as part of this effort, we're going to be looking at how to encourage more of the compostables to be composted rather than end up in landfills. Is that correct?
Correct.
And according to the chart on page four, right, the landfills are the biggest source. And presumably that's because people are putting organics in the garbage.
Correct. The composition of that organic material
right.
Is responsible for a large amount of
the of the methane. And so if people would put their compostables in the compost, that would go a long way toward dealing with this landfill chunk.
That's absolutely right. And but the second part of that story then is to assure that those facilities operate to not affect neighbors with odors or pollution.
Right. Correct.
So reduce organics in the landfills, but make those alternative systems operate as cleanly as possible.
Excellent. And will that include looking at things like biodigesters and, you know, strategies to turn waste into green energy, things like that?
Correct. Yes. That is one of the efforts that's in the cleaner plan and that we'll be focusing on. And if I may add that we did rename, we used to call this the waste strategy, and we did rename it to the organics recovery strategy to emphasize that we want to support those kinds of efforts of the low carbon life cycle for organics.
Wonderful. No, I think that's really great, and it deals with two different aspects that we deal with, right? Because if you're using biodigested energy, then that displaces fossil fuels, right, as well as prevents the methane emission. So I think that's a great win-win. And East Bay Mud has some of that effort. If folks haven't yet met that facility or want to go smell it, it's quite a tour. And so in terms of the different stakeholders you're working with, I assume you're working with the waste companies.
Correct. As part of Rule 13.1, we've been engaging the refining sector, the landfills, wastewater treatment facilities, some of the environmental groups that, such as 350 Bay Area and EDF, as well as the natural gas distribution utility, PG&E.
Fabulous. And you may have already planned to do this, but we also have some of these intergovernmental waste authorities like stopwaste.org in the East Bay. And so folks like that, I would imagine.
Correct. We're hoping that they will attend our external stakeholder meeting on the organics recovery strategy. And we're certainly, I'm sure, out of the planning division, have been in contact with many of those groups. I'm sure Henry can give you more details on that.
Awesome. Thank you.
Director Rice.
And waste haulers are also on that list because they're not, yes?
Waste haulers. I believe all parts of the system that are dealing with the organics.
And I bring them up because the waste hauler ends up being the one that has the interface primarily with the consumer who doesn't understand, or the consumer who's throwing their stuff away, who does not understand why their rates are going up as they compost and divert and X, Y, and Z. And I think that we need to, that education piece is so important on the consumer side about what we're doing, and then on the waste hauler side, keeping them really engaged and in the loop as they see things coming. And then, of course, they negotiate often their contracts with the local government. Mm-hmm. So the whole nine yards there.
Definitely. Thank you for the comment. We'll definitely take that into account going forward.
Thank you. Director Wagon Connect.
Yeah, one of the things that we're little Napa doesn't, we haven't divided up the we don't understand the methane really well yet for our climate action plan, and so this anything you can do to help us understand, you know, and find the real opportunities for us to work that into our program would be helpful. And I think I'm speaking for beyond just Napa, but I am speaking for Napa.
That's an excellent point, Director Wagon Connect. I do know we routinely engage in climate action plan work and work with governments, so I'm sure that we can include that going forward. Go
ahead. Director Wagon Connect, in fact, we've heard from Napa County staff, and we have a call with them tomorrow. We're looking at a early draft of the climate action plan, so we'll be sure to work with staff on any questions they have about those inventory.
And help give them some focus on the methane.
Certainly, yeah.
Thank you.
Director Ross.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to add to Director Rice's nine-yard green can, the whole nine yards that we need to know about, not just informing the public, but I think the directors, this one in particular, would like to know, because, you have the organic compostables, and then you have your yard waste. I mean, discerning what the inventory, how that inventory is bifurcated, and what actually we can do down at the consumer level, because most of us do have to deal with that burning question when garbage rates are reviewed. Mm-hmm. And if we're kind of, you know, charging on one side and trying to work the other end in terms of emissions, I think a good knowledgeable foundation base would be good for us, because we go back to our communities. We raised our rates last fall, and of course this was a question raised to us by one of our citizens. You want us to do this, but you're allowing more waste in the green can, so on and so forth. So I think you get the gist of it. Thanks.
Thank you, Director Ross.
Director Ronan?
Yes, just given how much of the methane is coming from biomaterials and landfills, if there's model ordinances for local governments to pass around this, around the country or even locally, with other colleagues on the board, I'd love to see those.
All right. Sounds great. Thank you.
Director Joya.
Thanks. I think this is a good outline of sort of a path forward. I just wanted to raise an issue that I know is always a tension. We need to address methane coming out of composting facilities, and the irony is that composting facilities are helping us achieve our state waste reduction goal. So we have a very good goal over here to reduce our waste stream, which we all want to do, and then but the other goal of reducing methane. So that's always the tension. We're trying to have them do it in the most cost-effective way, so we don't jeopardize the composting operations, but we also don't want the methane. So, I mean, that's, I think, going to be somewhat of an interesting discussion to find the best ways possible for those facilities, right? I mean, this has already come up.
I think from what we've observed, a lot of it comes down to best practices and helping those facilities incorporate best practices. And when they are operating like that, you know, the emissions really come down. So it's also about supporting the facilities in having the best practices.
Please give Kim? Mr. Director Joya 5 extra points for saying much better than what I wanted to say.
We're Contra Costa sticking together today.
Okay. Director Kim?
Well, I want to give 5 points to Director Kaplan for talking about biodigesters. And no, I appreciate you making this whole conversation about these sort of invisible sources interesting. I love the graphic on the curtain flights. I'm just trying to picture a plane going round and round and round. No, this is all good stuff. My question had to do with the emissions inventory, based on what you're saying, is low. And so when you get more information about these sources and leaks, the inventory is going to go up, right? So we don't know everything we need to know about this source category and all that. Is CARB doing similar work to try to tighten up its methane inventory? And in the end, when we have a better clue about the inventory, will this alter the AB 32 overall statewide plan?
Absolutely.
So the ARB, the state ARB, is doing quite a lot of methane mm-hmm. work, and we are leveraging some of that work. For example, Tier 2, I don't know if you can show Tier 2, Marcy, please. Tier 2 of the NASA JPL surveys are funded both by CEC and ARB as part of a methane, California methane survey that has been conducted in 2016 and will be end 2017, and which the results will be conveyed to us, I think, later this year. So we are working with them, sharing what we're learning on the Bay Area, but also leveraging their work to improve and refine our emissions inventory. However, it seems from some of the early work that indicates that most of the methane is attributed to biological sources. It seems like oil and gas, though it's significant, it's not the biggest, so it seems like that should drive our focus to those sources, organics recovery, for example, at least as a first effort. But I'm not sure how it may change if we see, big changes coming from this campaigns.
Anybody okay. I have a question about the sources. You said that we found that it's now 10 times higher than originally thought at the refineries, the emission of methane, and 2.5 times higher at landfills. But we don't have enough data for the wastewater treatment facilities. When are we going to get that information?
I think this year there will be some more flights that are have been contracted out with the same group, Scientific Aviation, and they'll be going around the landfills again, wastewater treatment facilities, and some other facilities of focus. So we will be having this data probably during this year at some point. Yeah.
Okay.
Hopefully by the summer, but I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you. Marcy, is there anyone from the public who'd like to speak on this issue?
I had Jed Holtzman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barrett and directors. No problem. Jed Holtzman, 350 Bay Area. Thank you to Adania for the presentation. We had a stakeholder meeting about some of this and appreciated that engagement. I just really want to highlight the missing methane. We really support direct measurement of pollutants. I mean, I think before this meeting, if you were to be asked how far off you thought your inventories were, you might say 10%, and you might consider that like an upper level of, you know, we're talking about 100%, we're off by 100%. So I think this should convey to us that self-reporting from permitted sources, which we're basically taking that self-reporting largely and adding up, is not necessarily the best data source from which to plan your regulatory actions. So as we plan based on the data that we have to do the best with what we have. You know, I would argue that we really need to be planning to overshoot our goals, both because of the precautionary principle, its own self, but also based on common sense and the actual data points that we're getting, that if we're looking at our emissions reduction graph and the goals that we need, and then we find out that we have twice as much super GHG as we thought, then we need to be working much harder than we even thought we did all of these times. So encourage some adaptive management on that. The other thing I would say is natural gas processing and distribution. Currently, the Air District's action on that is basically working with the CPUC on their proceeding. Done a lot of work at the CPUC. I much prefer the Air District to come to on my Thursday mornings. Really encourage the Air District to take some proactive action in this area. The CPUC does not have an established record of pushing the IOUs beyond their comfort zone, as many of you know from your own counties. Also, there are studies that show much higher leak rates of natural gas from the distribution system than we heard, perhaps up to 4 to 12%. So that would be another source of missing methane. And just not really seeing the urgency in waiting till 2020 to start individual action by the Air District. I think that cuts it, and really support all of this work. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further comments from the directors? No. Well, I would just
Can I add one thing? I'm sorry.
I only get in if Katie gets in.
You got to be fast. Okay.
Just, I actually did have a question and was wondering a little bit, get a little bit more information around the backstop levels that you're wanting to establish. And I understand that I think it makes sense to put something in place as a backstop, but I wanted a little bit more around how those numbers were established.
Director Rice, there was a couple of components there. The first was 10,000 ppm, yeah, which is the detection limit with the FLIR camera. So as we're coming by in our van, we can actually see that in a camera. And so the idea is if we find something like that, we can compel the source to fix it. The other thing is, if you're just measuring parts per million, it can be a very concentrated, very slow leak. So we wanted to focus on those leaks that were substantial, and the natural gas industry has done a lot of research on this, and they have found that over half of the pipeline leaks are in large leaks that exceed 10 pounds a day. So that's where we came up with the 10 pounds per day threshold.
I guess what I'm wondering too, so partly we're constrained by the technology we have and our ability to measure. That's one element that you spoke to first, but how onerous is this backstop level, these backstop levels that we're establishing?
We don't think they're particularly onerous, and that's why we're reaching out to all the stakeholders to ensure that we have a good understanding of how impactful this will be. The idea behind the backstop is just that, to make sure that if there is a big leak, we can compel somebody to fix it while we continue on the path of doing more stringent source-specific regulations.
I just want to make sure we're actually being not just reasonable in terms of onerous to the emitter, but reasonable in terms of incentive to try to avoid leaks.
Understood.
Well, okay, if I could add to that, I also want us to be sure that onerous to the to the people who live here. You know, I mean, where's the danger level? I have to ask you for a clarity point here, and that is that when you go from 10,000 parts per million to 10 pounds a day, I lose the connection. So what is the connection between those? What is 10 pounds a day in parts per million?
If you can imagine, say, a leaky valve, mm-hmm. and we get up close to it with a handheld meter and it reads over 10,000 ppm. So that's just the concentration of the pollutant. It doesn't tell us how much actual methane is leaking over the course of a day. So you'd put a bag over the leak, and you'd let it fill up. And then after a certain period of time, you'd take that bag back to the lab, and you'd actually measure how much is in the bag, and that would get you a mass emission rate as opposed to a concentration.
Okay, so that 10 pounds a day is at 10,000 parts per million.
If it was 10,000 parts per million, then we would go look at it, okay. And see if it was something that we would compel somebody to fix underneath this rule.
Okay, good. That does make that clear to me. Thank you. I appreciate that. And I also really appreciate that we are working on this, since over the years on this committee, we have talked about how methane is sort of the low-hanging fruit. And we really do need to. It has very negative effects, and we can't affect it. And I hope we move forward. Director.
What's his name?
Yeah. Hudson.
I want to stay with something Katie brought up, because I think we're always looking for what's a priority. I mean, how much money do you have to do whatever you have to do? And when I first saw that map on page 12, I thought that little purple dot there wasn't Chevron. I thought it was Golden Gate Fields. And I know that they have, well, I know that composting is a big component of what they do over there. I don't know where it is, though. And I'm thinking, we look at the obvious, the landfills, 51%. We don't look at second. And it was the same discussion I had with, I guess Karen isn't here yet, Skolnick yesterday, is, you know, we look at what's number one and we forget what's number two or what's number three. In the wintertime, everybody goes, particulate matter comes from wood burning. What's second? It actually took her a while to get to cooking. Landfill, then livestock. Where is this going for composting, and are we reducing emissions? Because going back to what the speaker just said, you know, we didn't realize what the 2% is. Well, actually, we did. There's a statement out of Pittsburgh they could reduce it to zero, and we still can't make our goals. But there is also a term to maximum technologically feasible and cost-effective. So I think as we go through this, we still have to use those boundaries of what's cost-effective to be safe and to start down this path that can get better and better and better. And I think it is through composting. I think that's what you were saying before I got off on a tangent.
So just to clarify, Director Hudson, the first regulation that we have in our organics recovery suite of regulations is for composting. We recognize that landfills are a bigger source, but we have a lot of new compost facilities that are coming up because of the waste diversion goals. And so we're starting with composting.
Okay, we're good. All right, thank you very much. We appreciate this presentation. No action is being asked at this point. Okay, so on to committee member comments, other business. Good. Time and place of next meeting is May 17th, and here at 9:30. So we're adjourning the meeting. Thank you.